Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And whether you're listening on the radio or watching on Channel 10 or checking out the internet stream at radioinsidescoop.com, we're awfully glad you're here to discuss a very important topic today, the topic of health care for Americans. We have health care constantly on the rise, way greater than inflation. Than ever before. We have HMOs controlling things more and more, and we have our federal government concentrating not on health care for the many, but on health care for one severely brain-damaged woman, Terri Schiavo. Yes, Congress met in special session, ran back from Easter, the first time the president had ever interrupted his vacation. 9/11 wasn't important, but he was going to sign a bill on Terri Schiavo. Well, this conversation that I'm beginning today began out of a debate. Congress should spend more time focusing on the 43 million Americans without health care and the thousands of Americans that die each year because they have inadequate health. Is Dr. Quentin Young. He is the chair of the Department of Medicine at Chicago's Cook County Hospital, the third largest city in the nation. Its largest public hospital. He is the chair of the Department of Medicine. He is also the national coordinator of physicians for National Health Program. Dr. Young, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy schedule and coming here on the Inside Scoop.
I'm very pleased to be here, and yes, we're in the middle of patients, but this is important. I'm glad to
be. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can also write on the blog, as so many of you already have, at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Dr. Young, I want to start with just the very basic question of whether there are Americans that are dying today because of inadequate health care.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. There are 18,000 deaths estimated, in a very conservative estimate, in year 2004 because of non-insurance. Beyond that, I would say that number is multiplied by tenfold. The people who have delay in care.
Health care.
He meant Medicaid, yes, for the poor. That's not true. Here's what is true. When you go to an emergency, the emergent question, they don't have to admit you. They don't have to have long-term care. They don't have to have follow-up. Medicaid is a benefit that you have to apply for. The bureaucracy is often very hard. It may take months before you qualify. And not having insurance doesn't qualify. You have to have a very low income, very low. In most states, poverty level, which means like $14,000 for a family of four. It varies by state, to be sure. But it's middle America, middle-class America, that doesn't have insurance. The people who aren't insurance, so they aren't included. So your opponent got it wrong. You were talking about people dying because they didn't have insurance. And you have Medicaid, you're not in that group, if you follow me.
Well, yes, let me ask you, what happens if someone, say, making $20,000 a year, so they're not at poverty level, they're not have health insurance, they can't afford it, and they have a life-threatening illness? Let's say, for example, they have kidney failure and they need dialysis, and they go to a hospital. At the same time, you have someone who does have insurance walk up to the same hospital needing dialysis. Can the hospital prefer the person with insurance and say to the person without insurance, I'm sorry?
Well, of course they can. They can't deny emergency care. Let's be clear on that. That's another problem, because what's happened, to give the full picture, many people without insurance or poor insurance use the emergency room as their primary care doctor. They don't go there for renal failure. They go there for a bad cold. Insurance. However, to direct your question, if the patients are not emergent, the hospital has, under the law, every right to decline to care if they don't have the resources to be paid. Not in an emergency situation, but in all the other and most of medicine is not an emergency.
Well, one of the reasons I raised the question of kidney failure is while they will die in a matter of weeks if they don't get dialysis, what happens for someone in that case?
Well, bad things. 18,000 of them die. And when I say 18,000, that's bare bones. That means that the study showed that was the reason, the lack of insurance. There are many other things that can contribute to death, distance from the place, the lack of facilities in the hospital. You could go on and on, but 18,000 deaths is a very stripped-down number, sample of the kind of social circumstance. 80,000 people are estimated die because of racial differential care, and that means everything from getting into the hospital to getting a high-tech procedure. The data is solid that people of color get fewer treatments and both the diagnostic and treatments than people not of color simply because of race. These are compared in severity of their disease, their insurance even. So you have this variety of reasons why healthcare is not up to the standard in this country.
Well, Dr. Young, I can tell you, I know for sure that the conservative listeners will be skeptical of your numbers. I know certainly that my debating opponent last Tuesday was, because I actually gave your number. I said 18,000, and he scoffed and said that's silly. Where do these numbers come from?
Well, these are Institute of Medicine in the first case. That's by far the most authoritative source. I would encourage any skeptic or any person who just wants to know to call our offices. We'll give them not only the references, but we'll send them the papers. Our office is pnhp@aol.com. That you can get on the web. If you're willing to make a phone call, the number is 312-782-6006.
And
312-782-6006. Every one of the things we're saying are documented in the refereed literature. I mean, the Journal of the American Medical Association, New England Journal, Annals of Internal Medicine, to name a few.
And PNHP stands for Physicians for National Health Program. Do you have a website as well?
PNHP.org is the website.
PNHP.org for more information. Now,
yes.
Of course, you are advocating as the national coordinator for Physicians for National Health Care National Health Program. You're advocating, as I understand, a universal health insurance for all Americans. Is
absolutely
that right?
Absolutely. Simplest way to understand it is Medicare for all, with the full knowledge that it'll be much better than Medicare. Our plan is embodied in House Bill 676, which is sponsored by some 38 congressmen. We hope to see that number rise to at least 100 during this next period. But the bill, it has no co-pays, no deductibles, no caps. It calls for comprehensive care of basic and more than basic health needs. It has appropriate, generous mental health provision. It provides for long-term care, and it has a generous pharmaceutical benefit. You won't have these extortionate prices that the people with insurance are subject to right now. And certainly it's a far superior to the joke that they passed last winter called Medicare reform?
The premium, the prescription drug bill.
It's a real tragic rape ripoff.
And I want to talk about that, too, later on in the hour. Let me just go, I guess, with the basic question first. Those that are opposed to universal health care, and certainly those that were opposed to Hillary Clinton's plan 10 years ago, they basically argue it's one of cost. They say that if everyone gets health care, people will use doctors too much. They will go in for a cold if there's no copay, and when really for a cold, there's not much a doctor can do except, you know, tell you to get lots of fluids and get lots of rest, and that therefore it will actually cost the country more than the current program. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Hogwash. Let me first deal with the national mania for health care. I'm a doctor of some 52 years. I'm sitting with a patient now, actually, who's very patient. The people don't like health care. If you think a minute yourself, no one likes an arrangement where you get tubes put down you, needles put into you, and my favorite, you have your clothes off while the other guy has his clothes on.
Yeah.
That's a joke.
Yeah, but no one likes going to a doctor. Dentist either, for that matter.
And the economists who put those barriers, who argue that that's the way to cut costs, the real answer is that they're nuts. people don't like health care. They've been convinced, thank God, that health care is a way to improve their health and relieve suffering. That's what I do for a living. But the idea that people are clamoring for health care, insisting on these things the way a kid in a candy store would do, is silly. Now, let me modify that one little bit. As a result of the national experience in the last 20 years with HMOs for profit, where the doctors were actually rewarded for limiting services, by that I mean a doctor got a bonus if he had fewer hospital days, had fewer referrals, had fewer emergency room visits. That put in the mind of the American people, understandably, a feeling that the terms of engagement with their doctor had changed, that the doctors understood the identity of the patient's interest with the doctor was modified.
In other words, the doctor wasn't working for the patient anymore. He or she was working for the HMO.
Working for the HMO's goals, which is maximum profits. Now, that's a tragic development. And I certainly don't mean to say every patient that sees any doctor has that attitude. But enough of them do to do a harm to the patient-doctor relationship. And I assure you, as a practicing physician, if that trust isn't there, if there's mistrust, you'll only get bad outcomes. And that's another byproduct of the I've mentioned them as we go along. It's distorted the emergency room and overwhelmed the emergency room ability to deal with true emergencies. Now we see that the system has poisoned relationships between doctor and patient. Very serious and very costly, by the way.
Well, I would think that if someone has a cold and instead of calling their doctor and being told get lots of rest and drink fluids, they go to the emergency room and tie up the emergency room personnel, that would actually cost a lot more to society than just calling the doctor and being told.
You're right, but let's be explicit. They present with respiratory symptoms of a cold to the emergency room. The odds are overwhelming. They'll get every test that they can do because the emergency room is worried about malpractice. They're dealing with a patient they never saw before and probably will never see again. So it's the wrong arrangement, but it's a byproduct of the profit-driven system that's taken over. This wasn't the way it was. This is all Reagan, Nixon innovations in an effort to, a fruitless effort to control costs. You control costs by giving people access, giving them decent care, using prevention rather than treatment as your main weapon against illness. And that isn't happening. Our proposal guarantees that. And that's why we're certain it's going to be the only answer, because not because it's so humane, it is that. Not because it's fair, it certainly is that. Not because it enhances the health status of the American people, it does that. It's because our present system is wrecking the economy. Our businesses, big and small, cannot compete in the global economy. To give one vivid example, Ford Motor Company, you may have heard of them. They make a car.
I have heard of them.
Yes. Ford Motor Company president, William Clay Ford, that's his name, protested in the Detroit Free Press about 2 months ago. He was whining, I would say, when pointing out his subordinate group, his affiliate in Canada, produces the identical car for $1,300 less because the Canadian health system takes care of the health package. So that now there are more Fords being built in Ontario than Michigan. This economy is fragile, our economy. We cannot put up with those huge losses. That means thousands of wonderful jobs, the river to Ontario. That's harmful, and I really believe, even though I'd love to have this come to pass, as a humane, egalitarian expression of national solidarity, it's going to happen because the economics dictate it. But it's not bad that it happens that way. Every other one of the industrial democratic countries of the world, I'm talking Western Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, Britain, you name it, even now in Asia, Thailand and Taiwan, these countries, each of them, one by one, have come to the conclusion that health care is so important to the national well-being that it's the responsibility of society, which means the government, to provide care for everybody.
And Doctor, I want to ask you about those things, too, because we have actually a lot of people who have written on the blog to ask about these specific countries. So
okay.
I promise I'll get to that. But first, I want to get to the phones. If you want to call in and ask Dr. Young, he's a doctor of 52 years. He's the head of the Department of Medicine at Cook County Hospital. He's the national coordinator for the National Physicians for health care, he's been advocating for universal health care. All you have to do is pick up the phone and dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Dr. Quentin Young.
Let me quickly point out, I'm no longer chairman of medicine. I was chairman of medicine at county for 10 years.
Fair enough.
And that's going on to other hands. It was quite a run. But
fair enough. Caller, yeah. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Mark and Dr. Young.
Yes.
I have been a nurse for many years. I'm 91 now.
Good for you.
Despite all the suffering and the inadequate care, I believe President Bush is planning to make some major cuts in the care for the poor.
No question about it. He proposed a huge cut in Medicaid. Wonder of wonders, even though his party dominates both houses, they voted it down. That's the first decent vote I've seen in a couple of years.
Well, that's good.
Well, but Dr. Young, aren't there some budget cuts? I remember, for example, children's health care, I think, kind of got the axe, didn't get the increase that it had been getting in previous years for population increases. What is the Bush budget on health care, if you can sum it up for us?
Well, the most important thing, they're going after Medicare, and they're trying to destroy it by having medical savings accounts. These are foolish notions that American people can put money aside with a tax advantage because it's tax-free and then use it as they need it. And the thinking of it, which is so reprehensible, is that if people are spending their own money, they'll be less likely to seek care. That is so wrong-headed. You want people to seek care. A system that works is one where there are no barriers. We have barriers in the form of copay and deductibles in Medicare and frequently in Medicaid, and you'd say, well, does that work? Sure it works. In proportion to the people's poverty, they stay away from care, and they delay care. And care delayed is often care lost, that is to say.
Well, I would assume that preventative care, that if you take care of yourself likely to get the kind of condition that requires the kind of emergency treatment, that's frankly much more expensive as well as being dangerous to health. I mean, for example, if you catch cancer early, I assume it's a lot easier to treat than if you can't catch it late, right,
well,
doctor?
Well, that's the knowledge of how we approach cancer. And that, incidentally, that generalization works for high blood pressure, which is the most important medical illness we have. It works for diabetes. It works for arthritis. It works for the diseases that are crippling and killing our people. Now, in fairness, because I'm always fair, I want to note that same miserable bill that gave us the so-called drug benefit, which was nothing of the sort, did indeed mend some weaknesses in Medicare, which had excluded, literally excluded, preventive care. By that I mean vaccination, mammograms, pap smears, and that bill put an end to that nonsense, and I like that part of it. But and also, would you believe, under Medicare until this last bill, they couldn't do a checkup. You couldn't ever go see a doctor just to find out if anything was wrong. You had to have something wrong. Well, that's been fixed, and I'm you know, fair-minded. I want to indicate that the bill did make that mild but important remedy in a
I went in training when I was in 1932.
Wow.
So
let me ask you, it's been now 70 years you've seen America's healthcare system. Let me ask you, caller, how have you seen it change?
Well, you know, I don't like the way the nurses have to work. You just can't.
Years ago?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we worked our eight hours, and that was it.
This wonderful woman is telling us about a major tragedy. The nurse profession is in jeopardy of going under. For just the point she's mentioning, in addition to long hours, they give them overwhelming numbers of patients. The typical patient in the hospital is different than it used to be. It's an intensive care type patient, and a busy, skilled nurse could handle two, maybe three of those. They get four, six, and eight, and they get people with far less training to assist. But nurses are burning out like crazy. This profit-motivated system is not yielding, not succeeding, but it is destroying.
Yeah.
Let me. Do you have anything else, caller? We have to go to a break. I want to thank you
very much
for your call,
Dr. Young.
And we'll be right.
I appreciate that.
I appreciate your remarks, ma'am.
As do I. We will be right back with more of the Inside Scoop. If you want to call in, this is your chance to really get along as our caller. But he has been in the field a very long time. He was the department, the chair of the Department of Medicine at Cook County Hospital, and he currently is the national coordinator of Physicians for National Health Program. Have you ever wondered how universal health care would work in America? Have you ever wondered about the experience of other countries, Canada and those in Western Europe? He is your expert, and I want to encourage you to call in. Toll free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can write questions on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be getting to those questions right after these messages.
For Anna Briggs, now 94 years young, the ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scruffy mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's baacs.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan? No. Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world.
Right. Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard? Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a
pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie, are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech, Language, Hearing Association and this station.
A new route to
Asia!
Good.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from the nation's capital that the government does not want you to know. And we're talking about health care. And my guest is a very highly respected doctor who has taken time out of his busy schedule to come on air and explain the benefits of universal health care. Apparently, he has a patient in the room with him. Thank you to the patient for being so patient.
We let her go.
Oh, we let her go. Well, I appreciate her also for sacrificing a little bit of her health care so that you can bring us, Dr. Quentin Young, the information that you are bringing us right now. And we've got a lot of comments on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We've got some callers. Callers, hang on a bit. I want to go to one of the blog questions, and it's posted by Vicky. It's a very good question. And she wants to know what universal health care coverage would be like. Would the patient be free to choose their own doctors? Would the doctors have a choice as whether or not to participate? Let me start with those two questions.
Okay. The answer is yes to the choice, and let me elaborate just a bit. You get a card, like a Medicare card. I've already said, and will repeat, the benefits are fatter, are better than Medicare, good as they are. But this card allows you to go to any doctor you want to. And to me, in answer to the people who want market solutions, who give people medical savings account to thinking they'll handle their money more prudently, that's not the market you want. You want a market where a patient can go, where she or he feels they're well-treated, got good results. That's the best market there is, and that's built into the House Bill 676 that we're mentioning. The doctor's choice. Well, in medical practice, doctors have a right to refuse patients, but not like that. They have to give a reason that they're panel is too filled or not accepting new patients. They may not, they repeat, may not, under present law, reject patients because of race or creed or age or any of those
things. What about medical condition? Can a doctor say, I'm sorry, I don't take AIDS patients or I don't take heart patients?
He may not put it that way. He may say, I need a more skilled specialist for this kind of care. But I assure you, in the 19 countries where we have universal care, where the entry, I mentioned your medical card, the problem of doctors rejecting patients is not non-existent. It's just not an issue. Maybe the patient has had some bad experiences or knows a bad experience. They do occur. In this present system, doctors clearly, and hospitals, avoid patients without resources. Let me dilate on that a little bit.
Please do, because again, the Republicans I've argued with say, no, that's not true. People, hospitals and doctors take poor people all the time. It's not a problem.
Yeah, they take them on occasion, but we just published. This is very fresh. It's in Health Affairs. Your people like to know the sources. The current issues of Health Affairs, that incidentally is considered the premier health policy journal, not in America, but in the world. There's an article by some of our people, and plus a lawyer from Harvard, on the bankruptcy question. And this was a study for the entire year of 2001. And they found that of the bankruptcies, which affected some 2 million people, in other words, the individual and the family, half of them, 1 million people, went into bankruptcy because of unpaid medical bills. And these hospitals that your Republican friends say they're taking care of people, they very often do take these people in either because they're emergencies or because they want to, and then proceed to harass them into bankruptcy, make them sell their homes, their resources. And our study showed that amount of medical bankruptcy had increased 22 times since 1980.
Well, now I should just mention that the Republican Congress has passed a bankruptcy bill to make sure now that you cannot seek protection from bankruptcy if you indeed have a medical problem to save a life and the hospitals are out to get funds from you. They will get from you until the day you die.
Well, we're close to that bill because our article was published coincidentally with this debate, and it couldn't have been anticipated because the bill, the research on this has been going on for the past 3 or 4 years. You're roughly correct, but let me be precise. This was
Please.
A bill to favor the credit card people, the folks who send you mail every day begging you to take their wonderful cards, and then when you get deep in debt and go default, they sue you. Well, the bankruptcy is the tragic way out for people who run out of money and resources, and it's supposed to wipe the slate clean. Well, believe it or not, these companies that charge these huge 18% rates for defaulted payments didn't like that, and they have power with Congress and proposed a bill that kept people vulnerable. You could go through a Chapter 7, which is not nearly as good as Chapter 11 in protecting a defaulted payer.
Let me interrupt you if I could, because I want to get back to the question of health care. I agree with you on the bankruptcy bill, Doctor.
Well, I just wanted you to know, this you should hear. Our research did modify the legislation a little bit, so they give a little better break to people who are in debt because of medical bills. We were startled that our research would have that prompt a yield, but Senator Kennedy was able to get two amendments that didn't make the bill good, but it made it much less hateful.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That is good news. Let me go to the phones. If you want to call in and ask a true expert in the field of healthcare, Dr. Quentin Young, and not just in the field of what he's done in his own practice, but really in national problems and national solutions, pick up the phone, dial 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or add a comment on the weblog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Dr. Quentin Young. Caller, are you
Hello?
There? Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, this is John Glass calling from California.
Hi, John from California. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, we are in the process of getting a national health care, universal health care bill through our state legislature.
That's right.
It's a two-year bill. Last year it was SB 921. This year it's called SB 840. And the question is, isn't it easier to try to do this state by state rather than trying to get a national universal health care bill, or should we be doing both at the same time?
That's a superb question. And first, let me congratulate you and all the people in California who are fighting for the cool bill, K-U-E-H-L.
Yeah,
but it could be cool, C-O-O-L, in my book. It's a marvelous bill, and while the governor is going to try and block it, I think it has an excellent chance because California is in deep trouble. They have 6 million uninsured in that state, which used to be, you know, so prosperous. Here's the story on the state strategy. In addition, California is the most advanced. There are at least a half a dozen states, including my state, Illinois, where there are initiatives to move toward universal coverage on a state level. Now, by definition, that's not nearly as good or as effective as a national program, but I'm increasingly convinced that that's the way it's going to happen. And in the process, I've learned a civics lesson, that that's the way most of the legislation we citizens think is federal. Social Security comes to mind, OSHA legislation, environmental legislation, women's suffrage before the national government enacted it. And it happens fast. They don't have a state initiative in 1 year and then 25 years the national. It happens in a very few years. In fact, it was best put by the late Justice Brandeis in a decision. He said incubator for the federal government.
I thought he said the laboratories of democracy.
Yeah,
but
he said both those.
Okay.
That's also a way we got Canada got their national health care
right.
by starting
went
in Saskatchewan. One of the provinces started it, and it worked, and then it spread to the whole country.
That's correct. And I believe, and the reason it's going there's a historical precedent we're just discussing, but beyond that, the forces who oppose it at the national level have huge power. Example, the drug industry. The most profitable major industry in the country. The drug industry has 600 lobbyists that are lobbying our Congress every day. 600 lobbyists doesn't mean one guy with a silk suit and a wad of bills in his pocket. It means that, but it means a staff, it means dinners, it means parties, and it means huge campaign finance contributions. And they have the Congress hogtied. It's tragic. I hate it. But I feel our democracy is threatened. So I think going the state route, not that they're not powerful at the state level as well, but it's possible because, as I said earlier, the hurt to the economy is so severe that people are overcoming the power of these lobbyists.
John, I want to thank you for your call. I think there are many, many other examples. Dr. Young mentioned a number of them, but where you cannot get a national bill through Congress, in this case the Republicans control Congress, but they don't control every state legislature. And I think if it succeeds in California, many things that start out in California, people start seeing they work and it goes nationwide. So I think you're doing terrific work, John. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you, and thanks a lot, Dr. Young, for everything you're doing.
Thank you for the compliment.
Dr. Young, a lot of people on the blog and also you yourself have talked about Canada. And I on the web blog, I get lots of comments, good and bad, frankly, about Canada. And people also mention other countries, France, Italy, Spain. I even have a listener who wrote in from Finland talking about the universal health care in Finland, where he pays $10 for a series of tests, and that's it. He gets free referrals to specialists. If he's too unwell to visit a doctor, the doctor visits them. And the total cost is about 4.7% of his salary.
Yeah. Let me start out by saying the citizens of those countries you mentioned and others think we're crazy. They can't believe that we're in such a scam that we're getting sick can lead to bankruptcy, and or getting sick doesn't mean you have access to care. They really think we're primitive and uncivilized, and I agree that their observations have a lot to merit. Let me, first of all, whatever system we get will be an American system. There's some things that have to be said up front because they're the usual distortions, that it'll be socialized medicine. There is such a thing as socialized medicine. They have it in Cuba. And there's such a thing as nationalized medicine, which isn't socialized medicine. They have it in Britain. Socialized medicine means the state runs everything from the lowest nurse to the highest specialist. They're all on salary. The state runs it. I don't think that would ever happen in this country, although Cuba is by far the most successful of the third world countries in health status. But then there's nationalized medicine. Britain has that. The doctors are employees of the government. And I don't think we'd have that. Then you have national health insurance, Canada. and that's what we're proposing. You just take the economic payment side of it, both the gathering of the money by a tax mechanism and the payment through a fair distribution system. Everything else is very much as we would like it to be here. It isn't any longer. I mean, doctors are private doctors. There is no such thing as for-profit hospital chains or HMOs. And even the drug companies, as we know from our bitter own experience, the drug companies have to be subject to regulation so that Canadians enjoy a 40 to 80% discount compared to us. Do I think that would work? You bet it would work. First of all, Medicare, which is most of that, not all, is working magnificently. For all the attacks and running out of money and all these Mickey Mouse suggestions, Medicare is the most solid part of our entire health system.
And of course, Medicare deals with the patients who need the most care. Obviously,
exactly.
People over 65 are more likely to be unhealthy than people in their 30s. It'd actually be cheaper than Medicare.
Let me give you one stat. The economics of it is that if we didn't have Medicare, instead of having 15% of our elderly in poverty, we'd have 50%. That's what a cushion Medicare is to our seniors. And we are living longer. And with longer life comes greater need. You get more disability, more chronic illness. And that, incidentally, has to be mentioned in this discussion. We have a time bomb of an aging population. And we have an equivalent time bomb, if that's the right way to put it, of our disability citizens and friends. These people with disabilities used to die from neglect, from their disease. Now our skills have gotten to the point, thank God, that we can keep them alive and frequently give them a very good life as opposed to the cruel punishment of being badly disabled. But that means it's going to take care, and it's going to take billions that we aren't spending now. Now, the good news, and let me emphasize this, Mark.
Go ahead.
The good news is that this is the only social problem we've got that has enough resources in it right now as we speak to do all the things I'm talking about. Why do I say that? The amounts involved are awesome. Last year, it was $1.9 trillion. What's that? That's $1,900 billion. What's that? That's a sixth of our whole gross domestic product. What's that? That's $6,400 for every person in this country. What's that? That's twice as much as the next three countries' expenditure per capita per year in the world. That's France, Switzerland, Germany, $3,200.
But could it be that because Americans have good medicine, at least for the wealthy in this country, that Americans demand more health care than they do in France or Switzerland? Maybe we have more heart transplants or expensive things like that.
The data doesn't support it.
Okay.
Taking Canada's example, they do have more bypass surgery, and they're working to fix that. It's a significant difference, but that's the only place. Canada has more transplants per capita than we do, more other transplants, heart and lung transplants. That surprises people when they hear that. Canada has waits for care. Of course, we have them too, but they are the difference between us and Canada is that when they identify a problem, they can use the democratic system to analyze the problem and fix it. And that's exactly what's going on as we speak. Premier Romanow, he was the premier of Saskatchewan, which was, as the listener pointed out, the first province of health care. He's no longer the premier, but the former prime minister, Chrétien, appointed him to a commission, one-man commission with a good funding and plenty of staff, to look at all the problems in the Canadian system. And the Romanow Report is a magnificent one in its thoroughness, and to me, the most exciting thing is it shows how a society where the commitment is to the health of the nation as opposed to maximum profits and denial of care can solve a problem. In brief, Romanow identified three or four major and a lot more minor problems, the big ones you can imagine, long waits for elective joint replacement, hip, knees, that the wait was too long. Long waits in emergency rooms, but I assure you no longer than in American labor. Shortage of nurses in certain places. And my favorite, he identified the fact that the Canadian system passed in 71 froze the distribution of care, the organization of the health system, in the 1971 mold, which was predominantly solo private practitioners. They have a paucity of Mayo Clinics and Clio Clinics and Cleveland Clinics and Kaiser Permanentes that we have, which are very good. And so he identified that and then identified carefully the amount of money it would take to shorten the wait in the ER, the amount of money to get those people with elective hip and knee replacements done, and how to build the nurse profession, and not least how to stimulate the development of more complex delivery systems.
Doctor, I have to interrupt you because we have to take another break, but it sure seems like in the Canadian system they are working to fix their problems, and which we're not doing here.
He identified the monies, and they've agreed to appropriate them. That doesn't happen here.
That sure doesn't. Let me take my break, and then there'll be a lot more. I also have callers. Callers, hang on. We will get to your calls right after this break. I also want to ask Dr. Young about what happened 10 years ago with Hillary Clinton's plan and whether his plan is similar to hers or different and whether it's got a better chance of political passage than hers. All that and more when we come back. Hang on, callers. If you want to join the calling queue, just dial 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back after this message.
But did you know that it's the number one killer of women nationwide? Some of these women may have it and not even know it. Heart disease claims more lives each year than breast cancer, lung cancer, or strokes combined. But there are steps you can take to protect yourself against it. While not smoking, daily exercise, and a nutritious diet are good for your health, they're critical in the fight against heart disease. Most important, get regular checkups and ask your doctor about risk factors, especially if you're over 40, when the risk of heart disease increases dramatically. For more information on how you can prevent heart disease, contact your local American Heart Association or visit their website at www.americanheart.org. It's never too late to protect your heart health.
If you give me a fish...
If you give someone a fish...
You feed them for a day.
Teach someone to fish.
You feed them for a lifetime.
Give me a fish, and you'll feed me for a day. Teach me to fish, and you'll feed me for a lifetime.
Through Volunteers of America, you can help change lives in your community.
As time flows on, there are places we return to again and again. Precious places. Timeless places. Places that, with your help, can endure forever. I'm Paul Newman. Help the Nature Conservancy save the last great places around the world.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. We had Congress go into dramatic emergency session to help, well, they thought they were helping, I guess, one woman who's severely brain damaged to try to keep her feeding tube so that she would remain in her persistent vegetative state for many years. At the same time, as they're rejecting plans to help ordinary Americans who are alive and well get adequate health care. My guest is Dr. Quentin Young. He is the National Coordinator of Physicians for a National Health Program and a former chair of the Department of Medicine at Chicago's Cook County Hospital. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP. If you want to write in, just write on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Let me go to the phones. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Dr. Young.
More of your California fan club here, Mark.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Great. And Dr. Young, I can't begin to tell you how much I appreciate you and what you're trying to do. I think it's absolutely wonderful. I'm so sad that you're up against neocon lunatics. You're probably not going to get an inch. But I'm wondering if you're reflective of a lot of physicians, because I suppose most physicians are in the upper income brackets and maybe can identify with the tax breaks and whatnot offered. But
That's a good question. Dr. Young, do you think most doctors support universal health care programs like yours, or are they against it, and if so, why?
I love the question. You've said several times what I do now on a volunteer basis is to organize for doctors. That's a tough job, but somebody has to do it. The news there is all good. Our group, Physicians for National Health Program, I would argue, and I think I can prove, is the fastest growing group of doctors in the country. We started in 88, and we had steady gains. We had about 6,000 members a year and a half ago when we had a congressional hearing, and we got published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, the Physicians Working Group proposal for single-payer national health insurance. This is a refereed journal, and we presented 7,700 endorsers, and I assure you the editors of JAMA insisted on verifiable proof that every one of those people were real people who had voluntarily done it. Since then, the number of endorsers of our program have gone to 13,000. Our membership is about 12,000. Now, that's a small fraction of America's 700,000 doctors, but it's not chicken soup or chopped liver.
Dr. Young, have there been polls taken of America's
exactly,
doctors?
Exactly, they have. And in academe, that's the doctors in the medical centers and medical schools, all the doctors, including doctors in training, come in about 62% favoring a single-payer system.
62%?
That's correct.
Favoring a single-payer system, meaning government universal health care.
Meaning universal health care. The doctors, a larger number of them, do get off the boat with the government side. Doctors are, as you pointed out, of a conservative bent, and we don't get that 62% endorsing the government tax scheme.
Well, doctor, pardon me for interrupting, but I'm just trying to understand it, and so my listeners can. When you say single-payer health care, now that's lingo that people use in Washington. What precisely does that mean?
Thank you, because it's very often misunderstood. It's so complex, people don't understand it. We have a house joke about a wonderful presentation of our program, and a guy gets up, a young guy, and scratches it. Let's see, I'm not married. That means I have to pay. That's a joke.
Single payer.
Single payer means you have 1,600 insurance companies now who cost about 25% on average administrative costs, not to mention the other vices of denial of care, limiting care, not covered, pre-existing. That's what the 1,600 give you. A single payer means you have one insurance company, like Medicare. Medicare is our single payer system as of the moment, and their overhead is between 2% and 3%. Canada, which we talked about a little bit, have gotten their overhead down to 0.9%, less than 1%. Now, in this country, each one of those percentage points is worth $19 billion. So there's a pool of money that would suddenly become available for all the things that were being denied now. So that's what single payer is, one insurer.
Well, does your plan do away with private health insurance?
It sure does. It does away also with for-profit hospitals, for-profit HMOs. So somebody says, well, where are you going to get the money to buy them out? Well, I remind anybody who says that, we had that terrible savings and loan scandal.
Yep.
Where we up to $500 billion to bail out all these bad debt arrangements, and the taxpayer of America was forced to eat that because they said anything else would be destabilizing to the economy. Now, we wouldn't pay for all their stock. That would be crazy. There isn't that much money in the world. We would pay for their material assets, clinics, hospitals, list, whatever, and we have a figure on that. It'll cost something to buy them out, but then we'll have a system of hospitals that are community responsive, not for profit, based on community needs and the way it used to be. And so with our medical care, we wouldn't outlaw HMOs as such. Kaiser Permanente and other similar not-for-profit agencies are very credible in some respects, better to many of the private systems, but we would not have for-profit. What does that mean?
Let me ask you, because I know in your experience, I mean, you work for Cook County Hospital, which is a non-profit hospital.
It's a public hospital.
It's a public hospital, and it's one thing that, frankly, that we were discussing, I think I was discussing with my family after the Tuesday debate with the conservative, and it's just a basic question that, frankly, I don't know as a non-doctor, and that is the standard of care different in the public hospitals and the private hospitals? If the for-profit hospitals are making money off this, does that mean they take less poor people?
It sure does. It means they have elaborate, efficient schemes to avoid taking care of people without money or with diseases that are costly that won't turn a profit. And they're very good at it. Let me say a quick word about government medicine, because most of your listeners are confused, I find. And as you pointed out, I spent 10 years of my life at a public hospital, and indeed, full disclosure, I trained there 20 years before that, a five-year training period. I was a very slow learner. So I know the public sector. I've been in the public health service. I was in the military, so I know Army medicine. And, of course, most of my life, including this very moment, I'm in the private sector, a practitioner in a small group, five of us here. Well, the public record of government in medicine is laudable. And people don't understand it. Let me give you a few examples that may jog people's intelligence. National Institutes of Health. This is the world's premier research group by a country mile. Every year, Congress has had the wisdom to increase the allotment to the NIH, and they in turn allocate these research monies to appropriate competitors. They don't give it out. You have to win on a competitive basis. And there's no question that our supremacy in biomedicine and science is due to NIH. And as an aside, speaking of drug development, most of the drugs that are being put on the market for huge profits were developed by NIH grants. And the drug companies, for a pittance, get a license to use that and sell it exclusively throughout the patent life. But I just want to stress that NIH government medicine is a big success. Public hospitals, we just mentioned. Public hospitals are the safety net for people who nobody else will take. In the Chicagoland area, Cook County, there are about 6-7 million people, a million of whom depend on the public sector. If we didn't have county and its clinics and spread out some 30 of them in the county, we would be, in the terms of health, uncivilized, barbaric. People would literally be left to their own devices.
And who pays for that hospital, for Cook
County
Hospital?
Well, it's a tax-based thing. But you know what? The data is clear that they do it at a much lower cost for whatever unit you want to use, visits, heart particular surgeries, educational. The public sector is a huge bargain. The private sector could never absorb them. Now, I would, in the best of worlds, I would like a single system for everybody, and I think our proposal would accomplish it. But until the private sector is vigorously willing to take care of people in need who don't have resources, we better defend our public sector. It's been going down because of the economy, and California, we talked, has lost about half of its public hospitals. Great hospitals like Charity in New Orleans, Philadelphia General, they've closed because the money dried up. But there's still a very serious number of safety nets, we call them, and that's in the public sector.
I still have Dave on the line. Dave, is there any other comment or question you want to make?
Well, I made one comment on the blog that you may or may not get to, but one of the big problems, obviously, is that these big insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies, they have sent their lobbyists to buy and own our government today. So Medicare is having to pay top dollar to reimburse these corrupt insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies. That's where an awful lot of the money is going. It's going to bankrupt Medicare, I think.
It's a good point. I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you so much for being there, both of you.
Yeah, doctor, I mean, we have, for example, I know that in the drug benefit bill, as Bush calls it, one of the things in it that really is shocking is it actually prohibits the government from doing what Canada does, that is putting the pressure, demand pressure, on these drug companies to lower their prescription drug costs.
Well,
it actually prohibits that negotiation, doesn't it?
It makes it a felony. If the Secretary of Health and Human Services would take the $40 billion he's going to have through this drug bill and went to the drug companies, and as you said, like Canada, not put pressure on, bargain. That's what markets
are
all about. He would get the, we don't even have to go to Canada. In this country, the VA does just that. The Department of Defense Medical Department does just that. And guess what? They get the same discounts. But these drug companies own the government, and they say the world will come to an end if we can't charge whatever we want. So they put in the bill, as you rightly point out, an abominable provision. It's indefensible in their terms. These are the big marketeers. They're the people who say the invisible hand will work at wonders. And then they prohibit the hand from bargaining.
Doctor, we only have a few minutes left. An hour really flies by when you have an interesting topic, and I got a lot of things I want to ask you. So as much as I hate to ask this, I'm going to ask you to try to keep your answers short.
You're
if you can.
You're asking a lot. Boy, that's hard.
I want you to try. Let me start with this question. When I talk with people about universal health care, what people of means, people, upper middle income people, say is, yeah, that probably would be better for the poor, and I can see that. But I'm concerned that if I want an expensive procedure like a heart transplant or something like that, then I won't be able to get it. How do you respond to people like that?
Well, it's ridiculous. First of all, that group of wealthy people who can call their own tune because they have the bucks is shrinking. Right now, I would say only the wealthiest 4 or 5% of this country has that kind of luxury where they can pay whatever it takes. It's no longer, and this is very important and one of the reasons we're going to succeed, it's no longer the impoverished, the people with 1 or 2 times poverty level income. This has gone into not only the lower middle class, the middle class, and is lapping at the shores of the upper middle class. So what they're talking about is a shrinking group. Having said that, the data is clear. We have the money, we have the personnel, and we have the plant, the hospitals, and so on, to take care of everybody. It's just the distortions of the system, the huge hemorrhage of money into the overhead bin. And overhead is a euphemism for marketing, for huge salaries, for inefficiencies, for huge amounts of money spent denying care.
Okay, let me go to my next question if I can, because I only have a few minutes left.
Well, I want to get that across.
No, it's an important point, and I'm very glad you did. I do have someone who writes in on the blog. Would it allow for alternative therapies or just conventional medical coverage?
Well, our bill is very liberal in that regard. They say any proven system, and it definitely anticipates some of the alternate medicine that has great popularity. But it would want to have standards analogous to the FDA standards, which incidentally are also being corrupted by our drug companies. Witness the withdrawal of drugs that were supposedly safe. We now have, your listeners may not know, that FDA is forced to take research on safety and efficiency paid for by the drug companies to accelerate their approval rate. And we've had some really scary withdrawals, Vioxx and the Bextra, big multi-billion-dollar drugs that were marketed and seemed safe at the time, but after they have a wider marketing experience, they prove to be dangerous, and they've been restricted or cut off completely.
I hate to rush you, Doctor. The
That's
hour's
okay.
drawing to a close. I have one last question, though, that I'd like you to address really quick, and I only have about a minute to do it.
I'll do it.
Try to explain how your program is different from what Hillary Clinton offered 10 years ago.
The world difference. That was a debacle. The only thing worse than that bill getting defeated would be that it had been passed. Seriously, that bill never got out of committee and should have. It was the Hillary's as their boondoggling worst. They made every concession. It was a 1,370-page bill full of very dangerous proposals. It never would have worked. Our bill is worlds apart. Ours is simple. A single-payer trading on the experience with Medicare and the VA experience, if you wish, and expanding the coverage to absolutely everybody, anticipating the role of preventive medicine and the aging population and the growing number of disabled people in our country who need our help. So ours would be unifying. It would be everybody in, nobody in, out. Even the Clintons knew their system would leave about 5 or 10% at best. My guess is it would have made things worse. So please, whatever else you think of our proposal, don't confuse it with Hillary Care.
Doctor, what is the number of your bill in the Congress, please?
HB 676.
HB 676, and who are the sponsors?
Kucinich, Conyers, and McDermott. McDermott's a physician from Seattle, and these three worthies have put this in, and we want to get 100 sponsors. We have 38. Any listener can call their congressman and say, why aren't you on that bill?
The number for the congressional switchboard is 202-224-3121. Thank you, Dr. Young, so much for taking an hour of your time to advocate for universal health care. We really appreciate it.
You're very kind. I know I was long-winded.
No, you are very, very interesting. I'm just sorry we only had an hour. Thank you, Dr. Young. Tomorrow we have an interesting debate Tuesday. I'm taking on the Bush administration, actually a spokesperson for the Treasury Treasury Department, Rob Nichols, is going to come on my program and try to defend Bush's Social Security plan. And we also have Barbara Cannelli from the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. You want the ins and outs of the Bush plan, what's right and wrong with it? Just tune in tomorrow, same time, right here on Channel 10 and also on the internet at RadioInsideScoop.com. This is Mark Levine signing off.